That takes us to 8:34 in the morning. This is Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
And I'm Kat Brooks. And on December 2nd, 2016, a fire broke out in a former warehouse that had been converted into an artist collective known as the Ghost Ship. 36 people were killed in that fire, the deadliest in the history of Oakland. Right now, two men, Max Harris and Derek Almina, are facing 36 charges of involuntary manslaughter for each person killed in that fire. Almina had been leasing the Fruitvale neighborhood warehouse as an artist collective and unsanctioned living quarters, and Harris has been described by prosecutors as Ghost Ship's second in command. We are joined this morning by Jonathan Axtell, a survivor of the Ghost Ship fire, and someone who took the stand to testify at the trial in Alameda County Court in June. Good morning, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Kat.
Hi. Thank you for joining us. I understand that from my producer, this is your first public interview since the tragedy took place.
Yes. In the wake of Ghost Ship, obviously, there was a ton of media attention in those weeks afterwards. And for those of us that were there, you know, it was a highly traumatic and intense time. And so for those that were close to the situation, it was really difficult to, you know, respond to all of the media attention. And it's really been, you know, in these 2-3 years after the event that, you know, my perspectives have started to solidify on the situation, what it means in the landscape of Oakland. And, you know, I now feel more comfortable, especially with speaking with you about some of my perspectives.
You sent over two beautifully written pieces about those perspectives, and I want to get into those in just a minute.
Sure.
But first, if it's okay with you, if you could walk us through that night.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, a note of context is I'm a music lover. I'm someone that has both been, you know, a patron to many music events in Oakland over the last 8 years, and also, you know, have been a musician and in some cases an organizer of music events. On the night of December 2nd, it was, you know, Art Murmur First Friday, a night, you know, in Oakland where everyone's out experiencing the, you know, the amazing vibrance of creativity in Oakland. And I was walking around Art Murmur and ran into one of my friends, Alex Gasson. And, you know, it was there that he and I met up. Him and his partner were kind of having a big night out because she had just moved from Finland. And so they were celebrating that. We decided to make plans to check out a music event. And Alex had been to the Ghost Ship previously. I had heard about the event just, you know, through word of mouth and Facebook. And, you know, we attended that event together. Found ourselves in Fruitvale, and basically, you know, it was around 11 o'clock that I arrived there with another friend, Chris Farstead, who also took the stand in trial. And, you know, the two of us, came into the building. I had never been there before. And so, you know, obviously it was, very ornate. There were, you know, artifacts all over the building. So I explored the first floor for a few minutes, asked someone about all the pianos that I saw on the first floor. And it really, you know, gave the appearance of a place that had been highly decorated and designed. So naturally, I, you know, went to find my two friends, Alex and Hannah, and came upstairs and, you know, found really a small group of friends who had shown up to an event early. You know, there were obviously 35 people in the room. We, you know, were kind of standing around talking. I saw Alex and Hannah sitting on a couch across the room. I came and sat in between them, just shared a minute of, you know, just celebrating the moment and talking about the fact that Hannah was here for a month. And it was a few minutes later that I stood up to go find my friend who I had come with, stood in the back of the room, and, you know, was taking in the moment. I took a picture, just, you know, was texting with friends, and then I looked down at the floor and saw a small stream of smoke coming out of a crack in the floor. And, you know, in that very moment, I knew that that there was a fire. And, you know, my head raised, and my friend Hana had crossed the room. Our eyes met. We both, you know, were immediately alarmed to the situation. And we called over to Alex and said, "Alex, we got to go." And in that moment, we, you know, turned towards the staircase, and you know, it was as if collectively the whole room at the same time realized what was happening. We started. I was a few steps away from the staircase, and I started stepping towards it. And as I was stepping towards it, a huge cloud of smoke covered my face, covered my body. And, you know, in that moment, it was very split moment decision of what to do. You know, it was either stay where I was or begin descending the dark staircase. And you know, my survival instinct set in. As I was descending the staircase, someone kind of pushed past me saying, the smoke, it's too much. I continued descending the staircase. As I descended the staircase, it became pitch black. I found myself, you know, just completely enveloped in smoke, trying to, turn on my cell phone flashlight, but couldn't even see my hand in front of me. I just kept making my way down. I was holding my breath, and made it to the bottom, and I saw the glow of the flames to my right. I you know, turned to the left, had no idea, you know, there were multiple corridors on the first floor. I couldn't see the exit, and so I was feeling with my hands in front of me, and I just kept moving forward, and then I hit what I thought to be a wall. And in that moment, you know, it was one of those moments where your life flashes before your eyes. And, I thought that thought that my life was over. And, all of a sudden I felt the wall move, and, it was actually a door, and, it was the front door. And so I swung the door open, and, you know, immediately outside saw just a, you know, complete chaos, people yelling, screaming, you know, very traumatized, just scene of disarray. And I knew that, you know, other people in the building didn't know how to get to the exit or couldn't see it. And so I turned on my flashlight, ran in, you know, thought that Alex and Hana were right behind me, thought that maybe, you know, I could lead them towards the door. I ran in three times yelling, "The door is this way." And when, there weren't people, you know, coming out, I realized that I needed, to try and find another way to get to them. And so people were starting to, climb over the fence next to the building, to try and access the side windows. This was, you know, just a total mess. People trying to throw ladders on top of a junkyard. We were all trying to climb up to these windows. I took a rock with my hand. I was standing on top of a car and just started smashing the window to try and get in. And, you know, it was a complete feeling of defeat. And I remember, you know, as we realized that no one was coming towards the window, you know, I was circling the building. We didn't know where there were exits at that point, or, you know, how people might have gotten out. And I was calling my friends over and over again. And, you know, after about 30 minutes, it became clear to me that no one else was coming out. And, And so that was the night of December 2nd and our experience there. There, you know, were not a lot of us that made it off of the second floor. You know, somewhere between 5 and 10 of us made it down. And so, you know, for this reason, it was important in the trial to have, you know, some witness of what had happened in terms of those of us that had escaped the room. And, you know, there was also the testimony of Sam Maxwell, who, you know, came out probably a few minutes after me, experienced deep smoke smoke inhalation. I didn't experience that same physical detriment because I had maybe gotten out a little bit earlier and had been holding my breath. But you know, I feel a great weight, of course, with having survived this, and I feel, you know, an incredible responsibility to the victims, to their families, and to this whole ordeal, and ensuring that my presence is to remind those that loved these people of what they lived for, not just what they died from. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm here with you today.
You use the word responsibility. There was lots of finger pointing post ghost ship. You know, the city blamed the fire department blamed the city. Clearly, people have blamed Max Harris and Derek Almena. Who do you hold responsible?
You know, I think one temptation, especially with a situation like this, is to oversimplify this situation. And in reality, you know, there are small decisions and very immediate decisions that were made. You know, in the case of Derek and Max and the Ings who own the building, the, you know, electrician who worked on the building, that, you know, there were immediate decisions that certainly affected the layout of the building, our knowledge of how to respond in that situation and knowing what to do. And then there are, you know, larger both background decisions that were made, larger environmental aspects of how things run in Oakland, and you know, the way in which the city has just been really, you know, trying to keep up or just be responsive, versus, you know, taking an active supportive role to, you know, the more vulnerable communities of Oakland. And so I think, you know, in terms of this situation, I feel that there is, of course, responsibility on behalf of the people that were immediately involved. But I think we need to take a hard look at who we are as a city, not just, and when I say that, not just governmentally. I think we as a community, as citizens in this place, need to take a hard look at where we place our value in this city. And the truth is that we have not protected, we have not supported, we have not given the level of care that's needed to the more vulnerable constituents of the Oakland community. And so, you know, for that reason, I feel that we, though it's important, of course, for people to be held responsible, specifically Derek and Max, that we also need to take a bigger look at how we move forward and stand for what many of the people who were victims of the ghost ship fire stood for in terms of the types of people they valued in the Oakland community.
Can you talk a little bit about the scene that Ghost Ship was a part of? There were a lot of art spaces in warehouses, many of them with code compliance issues, but you know, that was partly a function of where artists could afford to operate. We've been doing a homelessness series, and a number of people we found in homeless encampments are folks who were evicted from those spaces after Oakland started cracking down on fire hazards.
You know, the truth of it is that it wasn't just post Ghost Ship. In the months leading up to Ghost Ship, I can list off, you know, five different spaces that were more regularly used for art and music events that had been, you know, shut down due to really like the greed of landlords, the development agenda of the city. There were certainly safer places where music events had been held. And it's my understanding that really even the selection of the Ghost Ship for the event that night was one of, you know, kind of last resort and desperation. The Ghost Ship, I had never been there, and I had attended music events regularly in Oakland. I didn't perceive it to be a core space in the you know, DIY community. These are, you know, typically spaces where, you know, shows of, you know, anywhere between 30 and 60 people get together. Usually it's friends and people that are loosely associated. These are people that maybe don't feel comfortable in bars or don't have the money to spend a bunch of alcohol in bars or don't feel comfortable, you know, being in the typical bar scene and view these spaces as places that are safe havens. You know, many individuals queer, many individuals who don't, you know, fit into the typical mold of, you know, who might show up in a bar scene. And so they seek out community in these informal places. They're very important to people being able to find their way. In many cases, you know, a lot of these individuals have experienced trauma in their past, and they're working out those traumas through art and music. And so, you know, it always surprises me, you know, that there wasn't more of a focus on the fact that that really, you know, 10 months before Ghost Ship, there would have been many alternatives for where this event could have taken place. And, you know, instead we find ourselves, you know, shutting down more spaces as a result of this event. To me, it should be, the response should be more support, more safety, more alternatives for the art and music community.
Take us into the courtroom with you, Jonathan. What was the tone and tenor, and what was it like, you know, I mean, you're a survivor, clearly that had to be triggering. What was it like for you to take the stand, see Derek, see Max, and go through that experience?
So for me, you know, I had no previous contact with Derek and Max. You know, obviously staring at them, giving my testimony, there is a certain intensity to that moment. I personally, you know, I mentioned this earlier. I think there's responsibility on their part. Definitely in terms of the decisions that were made. I think from my perspective, I want, you know, a fair decision, a fair sentencing in terms of their involvement. But then I think the more intense part of being in the courtroom was really, you know, facing the parents who have experienced so much loss, looking out on their faces, you know, them envisioning, you know, my testimony and what their children were going through. And, you know, I think about their pain every day. I consider the loss that they're going through. I feel it myself. This has not been, you know, something that's been easily moved from or moved beyond in my life. It's a burden, but, you know, a as I said, also a responsibility that I have carried with me. And so seeing them was certainly a heavy moment. I understand their deep feeling of a desire for justice and for understanding just the bare details of the situation. I think many of them, you know, had no idea for, you know, a year or 2 years what had even happened in the room. And so I think the case has been an important time for them to be able to search through some of those details, and I support that. And for me, as I mentioned before, I think it's important for us at this moment, and it behooves us in terms of the lives that were lost and these individuals, that we begin to focus on how we shift the culture of the way things are in Oakland and in the Bay Area in general.
Well, to that point, Jonathan, sorry to interrupt you. We just only have a couple of minutes left, and there's something I want to get to that I feel was really important in the pieces that you sent over. You talked about the subsequent West Oakland fire. And you talked about it in the context of gentrification, the lack of city investment in marginalized communities, and the difference in response to those fires. So if you could just elaborate on that. I'm sort of just asking you to continue what you were saying, but rooted in the specifics of that piece of your analysis.
So 4 months after Ghost Ship, I woke up in West Oakland and saw a billow of smoke above my house, 3 blocks away on San Pablo Avenue. There was another fire. This was at a low-income housing project on San Pablo. I knew that I needed to be there with these people who were experiencing the same thing that I had experienced in Ghost Ship. And so I biked over, found a scene, another scene of chaos, and through a series of events became involved with just getting to know some of these people and hearing their stories. And I was very disheartened by the absence of attention that had overwhelmingly captured the media and public in the wake of Ghost Ship, and found it very unfair that though our experiences were the same, and many of them had, 100 of them had lost their homes, that they weren't given the decency of the public attention that Ghost Ship was given as a result of their race and economic status. And I think that what this really gets to is the way in which our region is currently valuing the human experience, the contribution of those that don't contribute to, the typical economic narrative that has currently overtaken the Bay Area, and our neglect and in many ways general dysfunction towards these marginalized communities. And so, I believe that as we think about the people that were in the room at Ghost Ship and what they lived for every day, what they stood for, these are people that I saw at Occupy, at Black Lives Matter, that I saw in the days after the Trump election protesting, that I saw out on the street helping people day to day, that it was this spirit that they valued, and this spirit that we as people that are responding to and are
last thought, Jonathan, we got to wrap up right this
these
second.
People that are affected by this situation, they're where we should focus our time, and that is how we honor
Jonathan, thank you so much.
The Ghost Ship Fire. Thank you.
Jonathan Axtell survived the Ghost Ship Fire. He took the stand to testify in the trial. Testimony has now concluded. Closing arguments will start on July 29th. That does it for the show. Stay up, stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming your way in 1 minute at 9 o'clock.